And now, I'll turn the meeting over to one of our directors, Robert Mylod, Chairman and Chief Executive Officer, Michigan National Corporation, who will serve as our presiding officer today. Bob?
Thank you. It is my honor and indeed privilege to introduce the president of Hillsdale College, Dr. George Roach. As many of you know, and as we will all find out today, his voice and ideas are becoming increasingly resonant throughout our country. Dr. Roach was raised and educated in Colorado and spent 2 years as an officer in the United States Marine Corps, and then most of the rest of his impressive career as an educator, the last 24 years of which he has spent as the chief executive at Hillsdale. Let me briefly mention to you some of the institution's more important new initiatives during Dr. Roach's tenure. Imprimis is a periodical with more than 500,000 subscribers nationally. It provides penetrating comment on contemporary cultural and political issues. Incidentally, one of the other founders of that publication, Clark Durant, is providing new, exciting, and uplifting vision as the head of our state's Board of Education. The Center for Constructive Alternatives conducts academic seminars for the student community, drawing on prominent national speakers. The Chavanaugh Institute for National Leadership conducts adult seminars nationwide, again using highly sought-after national speakers. The Ludwig von Mises Distinguished Lectures in Economics are published annually by the Hillsdale College Press. And the Washington Hillsdale Intern Program allows students to spend a semester in Washington with congressional or journalistic staffs. I think that's a great idea, Doctor. I'm sure both those staffs can benefit from the education. Hillsdale Academy is a private model school for kindergarten through eighth grade students. Now, as president of Hillsdale College, Dr. Roach has surely added to its luster. Hillsdale's reputation is growing nationally as a strong liberal arts educational institution. In support of a 150-year tradition of maintaining financial independence, particularly from government intrusion, Dr. Roach has launched Freedom Quest, a $200 million funding program. And any of you graduates from Hillsdale, I'm sure, have heard of this program. Behind all of this is a man of ideas and principle. One of his favorite sayings is that ideas actually rule the world. The ideas that he carries in his heart and head rule the conduct of his life, undergird the relationship that he has with his God, and strongly define his leadership. His focused, undiluted philosophy has attracted support from all across this country. For example, the recently deceased father-in-law of a friend of mine directed his financial support for higher education exclusively to Hillsdale, although he never set foot on the campus. Hillsdale has many such supporters. It does because it is a unique school, a beacon of liberty and truth, run by a unique, committed, and highly effective leader. Dr. Roach will describe The Fall of the Ivory Tower, which is the title of his most recent book, which is also now in its second printing. Please join me in a hearty welcome for Dr. George Roach.
Bob, thank you very much. My thanks to all of you for making it possible for me to be here and share something with you today. As you heard, I've been at Hillsdale 24 years at a time when the average college or university president has a tenure of about 4.5 years. This makes me the oldest living thing in American higher education or close to it. But the time I came, I was purportedly the youngest, so they said, I was purportedly the youngest college president in the country. And if I stay just a little bit longer, I will be the oldest college president in the country. Why I'm still there after all these years? Simply put, because of the uniqueness of this institution. We are proud of the fact that we do not accept federal money on the campus. This permits us, among other things, to defend traditional values, to defend the sort of education that used to be the commonplace throughout American higher education, to defend those things which in fact make our civilization possible. We feel that sort of an education is absolutely fundamental to what ought to be passed on to the next generation. We're able to do that precisely because we do not participate in the politicized climate that pervades so much of higher education today. And so I'm proud to stand before you and say that Hillsdale College is the most politically incorrect institution in the country. We must be doing something right. Now, there are about half a dozen national rating systems of the best in the country, the Peterson's Guide of the 300 best, and the New York Times 200 best, and the Money Magazine 100 best, and Bill Buckley's National Review list of the 50 best. We better be on that. But in one way or another, we regularly appear as one of the best in the country on each of those lists. We have students from some 44 states, as Bob told you, and now nearly 600,000 readers on our Imprimis list. Usually I'd be going on and on about Hillsdale, as I just have, but today instead I'm going to be talking about my last book, which seems to have stirred a fairly substantial controversy. Over the last several years, more and more facts seemed to come to light, which made it abundantly clear to me that something was fundamentally wrong in higher education that seemed to have a common source that spread throughout everything that we were doing. And finally, that has spread from higher education increasingly throughout the rest of our culture as a whole. The result of this thinking about it was my last book, The Fall of the Ivory Tower. A few facts from that book. Number one, higher education is big business. It is America's top growth industry. In the 1960s, the average total cost of all American higher education was approximately $7 billion. Today, in the 1990s, the average total cost of American higher education is $170 billion. Not only is this a hugely expensive enterprise, it is truly big business, it is also one of the worst-run businesses in American history. In spite of a massive infusion of money, tens of thousands of college seniors do not know when Columbus sailed to the New World, who wrote the Declaration of Independence, why the Civil War was fought. As many of you in this room know, businesses often now must re-educate college graduates in their basic economic skills before they become useful to their companies. These are startling failures. They're made even more startling because America's higher education system, frankly, has enjoyed a well-deserved reputation as the best in the world. I believe that system and its success was based primarily upon our diversity, upon the privacy of a system so that various schools could go in different directions, could be uniquely what they are as institutions to follow their major, their particular mission statement as they chose. Compare, for example, most of the traditional patterns of private higher education with most of the rest of the world. Compared with England, where there is only one private university, with Germany or with France, where there are a handful of private schools, but in most cases where they are so regulated as to be identical in every detail with the public institutions in those countries. Or compare it with Australia, where there has never been a private institution of higher education in the nation's history. The root cause, I believe, then, for this radical and adverse change in American higher education is government. Somebody in the room is going to be thinking, if not saying, well, no, the real problem is all those campus radicals of the 1960s stayed on, took their doctorates, went out and became assistant professors, associate professors, and today are the tenured professors on many American college and university campuses. You're quite right. They are there. I went to graduate school with them in the 1960s. They no longer wear caftans and beads and sandals, no longer drive Volkswagen minibuses. Today it's a tweed jacket and a pipe and a BMW, but it's the same people and the same politics. You're quite right. However, the better question is, how did these radicals ever acquire such control of so much of contemporary higher education? And quite frankly, I believe the answer is that government money has created an academic welfare state with a huge amount of entitlements peculiar to the academic community, very similar to the system of entitlements that plagues the rest of our country just now in so many other areas. The result of those entitlements, the result of this peculiar process which has developed as the result of government money, is that American higher education is today academically, morally, and financially bankrupt. Let me give you a few examples of what I mean. I'll be naming names of particular institutions. If your alma mater happens to come up, please don't be offended. I don't mean to single it out. In fact, most of what I'm describing today in these examples is the widespread dominant pattern of American higher education today. In fact, I found the main problem in writing the book was not to find material sufficient to produce the book, but to decide which of innumerable examples should be highlighted as illustrations of the point. Anyway, let's look at each of these crises in turn briefly. Number one, the financial crisis. Nearly 60% of American colleges and universities have had to slash their budgets within the past 2 years. Harvard, Stanford, Columbia, MIT, the University of Michigan are just a few of the institutions that rack up bills in excess of more than $1 billion a year. They are overcommitted to entitlements in exactly the same way as if the government, with exactly the same effects upon the budget. Yale University has deferred a total of over $1 billion in maintenance on its physical campus. The City University of New York system is looking to cut, this year was looking to cut some $40 million from its budget. UCLA has had to close four professional schools and cut some $38 million from its budget by the end of 1994. Stanford University had to cut $22 million from its 1991 budget. Since then, it has been compelled to make over $40 million in additional cuts. The University of California system has cut some $900 million from its budget in the past 4 years. Thousands of students have been turned away from classes. The talk on the street now is that things are so bad that there is possibility, at least growing concern, for the fact that the system, the entire state of California system, may have to be privatized before the year 2000. Worse yet, for all of this financial difficulty, and believe me, I could expand the examples endlessly, there seems to be no financial bailout available. Corporate and private giving right now account for some 8% of all higher education revenues, only 8%. Federal and state aid has grown by leaps and bounds since World War II. Until today, it is the lion's share of the money reaching American higher education. And now that money has not only leveled off, but even before the present Congress convened, it was clear that the amount of money available to higher education from the process was very, from the federal source, was very likely to decline. For example, the Stafford Loan Program, the principal loan program today for federal-funded loans, is so in default that it will scarcely operate. There have been nearly $100 billion of your monies allocated for those loans. Nearly 70 billion of that 100 billion have disappeared in either administrative costs or defaults the first time it went through the loan process. 70% of that money is gone. The Pell Grant, the principal grant program of the federal government for student aid, is doing very little better and is several, each year is virtually millions of dollars behind in arrears between the money that Congress says it would like to give and the money it is actually able to give. The result of all this is something very like an SNL financial crisis. The savings and loans have many similarities with American higher education today, believe me. Both suffer from bureaucratic meddling, a credit crunch after years of very easy money, chronic mismanagement, and massive overinvestment. The SNLs went down as a result of that, and I predict that higher education will be not that far behind them. Meanwhile, the politicians are doing what they always do best. They are making the situation worse. I mentioned loan defaults. Imagine 70% of the money in all of the Stafford loan programs are already gone. Now, let's talk about Pell Grants for just a moment. In the state of New York alone, in the past year, 34 non-existent institutions of higher learning collected Pell Grants for non-existent students attending their non-existent schools. It is possible to be in the penitentiary for a life sentence and continue to receive Pell Grants to further your education. There is one undergraduate now completing his 17th year of Pell Grants, and we hope that he graduates soon. Meanwhile, the Department of Education has done such a wonderful job of mismanagement that now Congress has decided to enlarge the Department of Education authority. Before, they had only the responsibility of monitoring federal loans. Now, in the current arrangements, Department of Education now has the direct responsibility of making some 6 million loans a year. Congress also raised the ceiling for individual grants and loans, in some cases by as much as nearly 50%. They abandoned all financial need requirements for those loans. What this has done, in effect, in the current year, is increased by 1.1 the number of new borrowers in the loan program, and by 1.4 million the number of grant recipients. Over 2 million new hands lining up for the federal funds, which are quite clearly already not there. The money is simply not available to continue the course that American higher education has been pursuing. Along with this, costs and tuitions on American college campuses are out of control. Costs have grown three times as fast as the rate of inflation in this country. Tuition costs in American higher education three times as fast as the rate of inflation. At more and more American schools, the total cost of attending for 4 years now exceeds $100,000. Meanwhile, Washington is subsidizing tuitions through federal grants and loans and leaving colleges free to jack up their prices. The system goes like this. Those politically correct professors, the radical faculty I was talking about who are running many of these institutions, decide the budgets with no real restraints placed upon them. The administrators of these institutions, if that's the right word, then pass that total cost through and say, we'll just increase the tuition to cover it. Then the colleges and universities all run to Washington, D.C. and say, it costs so much to go to college, Johnny needs more help, we need to raise federal subsidy for student aid to higher education. So the real reason that higher education has become so expensive, so prohibitively expensive, is the direct encouragement of federal subsidy of the process. Along with this, it's well to remember, even though it costs a lot to go to school, that less than 20% of the total monies reaching American college students are now, to pay for their education, are now generated by tuition. Less than 20%. Most of the rest of that money is now picked up by the American taxpayer. Heavily financed by federal and state aid, colleges and universities have indulged in a spending spree in the last half century that has no equal in American history. For a long while, there seemed to be an endless amount of money available, so much money that it could never go wrong. We'll just keep growing. More is better. Bigger is better. Well, now we've reached the point where those laws of supply and demand, so long neglected, are about to force consideration in the equation once again. And the result, imminent financial crisis. Within this decade, Many American colleges and universities, including many recognizable name institutions, will be forced to do a major restructuring of their financial situation if they are to continue in operation. So much for the financial crisis, and believe me, those are only a few samples of a very widespread problem. Let's go on and talk about the academic crisis for a moment. This academic crisis, this academic failure, takes several forms. One of them is the phenomenon now called political correctness. This is nothing less than a deliberate assault upon the Western tradition. At Hillsdale, we believe with all of our hearts that no matter how a young person will be earning his living, that young person has the basic necessity to be educated in the values and structures which characterized Western civilization at its best. Individual dignity, individual responsibility, the whole body of drama and economics and philosophy and literature that made that clear. The British liberties of the individual subject, the Greeks, the Romans, the Old Testament, the New Testament. And those are all things completely neglected and in fact attacked by the phenomenon called political correctness. Surely that in itself is one major academic failing on many American college and university campuses today. Along with this, in an effort to play financial catch-up, many of these colleges and universities have also been adopting a cattle car approach to education. It is not uncommon to have 500 or 1,000 students at a time in various college classrooms. At the University of Wisconsin, registration has often been closed in the last few years in the first hour after registration began, even for seniors in their major field of concentration. At the University of Texas this last fall, nearly 1,000 students were turned away from a required English course that they needed to graduate. Students already in the school, sorry, that's not available. Meanwhile, only about half of American college students ever graduate undergrad from college. Among the half that do graduate, about half of those require more than 6 years to complete their work. As one educator candidly admitted, this is a condemnation of higher education. If we were running an automobile plant, we would be out of business. Along with this, there are other forms of academic failure. I believe that faculty work on many campuses today amounts very close to consumer fraud. The average professor is in class in the United States today less than 6 hours a week. At the University of Michigan, some professors there are paid so much and teach so little that their contact time with students now exceeds $1,000 an hour. Teaching assistants teach 25%, 50%, as high as 75% of introductory classes at Princeton, the University of North Carolina, Ohio State, Stanford, Berkeley. 60% of all faculty have never written or edited a book. You know, the reason that they don't teach classes is because they're busy doing research. Not so. 60% of them have never written a book. One-third have never published a single article, period. And the faculty books that are published are almost astounding. They range from the sublimely ridiculous to the sublimely obscure. Let me give you a few current crop of the titles published this year, in the last 2 years, say, in American higher education. And these really do exist. The Sexual Politics of Meat, Critical Feminist Vegetarian Theory. Mama Lola, Voodoo Priestess in Brooklyn. Boots of Leather, Slippers of Gold, The History of a Lesbian Community. Staying Tuned, Contemporary Soap Opera Criticism. Men, Women, and Chainsaws, Gender in the Modern Horror Film. To review very briefly then, the curriculum is a shambles, the professors are grossly overpaid and underworked, students are teaching other students, and much of the research being done today is of very questionable worth. Now, having made such a glorious mess of American higher education with the huge amount of money it has received, American higher education is now saying that its problems can be solved in only one way, with more money coming from the federal government. So much for the academic crisis and the financial crisis. Let's go on for a moment and talk about the moral crisis. There has been a concerned effort on American college and university campuses to destroy the old in loco parentis idea in place of the parent, assuming, of course, that parents, when you send your sons and daughters off to school, are interested in what happens to them there. You've tried to nurture the kids and bring them along. Now what are they going to do? All right, and presumably you want them in a general atmosphere, in a general environment, where what they are learning there is at least reasonably conducive to their continued growth as individual human beings. Well, that in loco parentis role is poo-pooed and dismissed on most college and university campuses today. Educators, however, are willing to meddle as much as they wish to when it comes to introducing students to the so-called sexual revolution on campus. There are condom weeks in a number of colleges, including Stanford, Berkeley, San Jose State, Virginia Tech, the University of Iowa, the University of North Carolina. These condom weeks are complete with free samples and with something that I don't want to know any more about called taste tests. At schools like Pennsylvania State University, the official policy of the institutions is that students may not be granted a room change on the grounds that their roommate is a homosexual. Columbia, Harvard, Middlebury College, MIT, Stanford, the University of Minnesota, the University of Vermont, and Yale are among the schools around the country who have already placed so-called domestic partner provisions that allow gay and lesbian couples to receive insurance and other spousal benefits on campus. The University of Massachusetts at Amherst has defined pedophiles, persons who prefer to have their sex with children, as a, quote, protected minority within the non-discrimination code of that institution. At Cornell University, resident advisor job applicants, if you want to be an RA in the dormitory and are a young man, you have to come, first of all, and be shown, together with other potential RAs, a movie featuring the explicit sexual relations of adult males. And if you're queasy about that, if you're uncomfortable, if you're outraged, if you're anything but think that's just hunky-dory, you are dropped from the program for your homophobic tendencies. You can't be an RA at Cornell University if you're not reasonably comfortable with that entire process. Another byproduct of the abandonment of morality, incidentally, on campus is the soaring crime rate. Most schools will not truly report that rate any longer. Of some 580 campuses in the country who are willing to report, they average annually 2,528 assaults, 15,313 burglaries, 5,081 car thefts, 928 robberies, 493 rapes, and 16 murders. So much for the moral decline. Colleges and universities look very much like large businesses, but they are not organized or run like business. Professor Martin Anderson of the Hoover Institution calls them mini socialist states. And that's not an unapt phrase. Since the 1960s, control has increasingly shifted in the process that I've described, funded by federal dollars, from the administration and the trustees to the faculty of these institutions. And as the result, federal funding has now led to a breakdown of effective decision-making, to the tyranny of the majority. Believe me, if you're not politically correct on many campuses, you'd better watch it as a student or as a faculty member. And finally, has led to control without accountability, in which the people making the decisions and handling the budgets are not the people who, in fact, have to carry the load, who have to run the school. Now, at this time, when things are already so bad, state and federal cuts now mean that our colleges and universities will have to perform better than they ever have before, and most educators are still insisting that only more government money can somehow save American higher education. Government money, as you know, always appears so comfortable, so easy, so safe, so painless in its original process. There don't seem to be any strings attached. But of course, nothing finally is dearer than free money. Private colleges have learned that even indirect aid, aid going only to students and not to the institutions as a whole, somehow presumably makes those institutions wards of the state as far as government is concerned. Government funding also wrongly shields colleges and universities from the normal, healthy forces of the marketplace. The business community goes through a business cycle every several years at the outside in which you'd better shape up and be ready to compete, or you will be one of those companies reliably referred to in the past tense. There has been no such occasional restructuring of American higher education, and since the Second World War, it has grown like Topsy, enormously, from $7 billion to $170 billion a year, with no real controls or restraints, and with no clearing process to separate the weak from the strong. This will not continue. The best news of all may be this coming financial crisis. More money, remember, didn't bail out the failing SNLs in the 1980s. They simply misspent the new money the same way they'd misspent the old. Failing businesses only recover when they engage in a fundamental restructuring of the way in which they do. I painted a very dark picture of you for higher education, and I don't mean to have spoiled the digestion of your very nice lunch, but I think an enormous opportunity for us is present here. I think it is possible now to return to an earlier American higher education with diversity, with standards, with privacy, precisely because of the magnitude of these problems. The financial and reputational crisis which American higher education now faces is going to force a re-examination of priorities. What are we teaching? How do we allocate our resources? Who's making our decisions? And guess what? For the first time in a long time, the consumers of the product, that is to say the alumni, the donors, the parents, the students, are going to have their first say in a long while about what is really happening on college and university campuses. Their impact can be very great. The reform benefits can be very healthy. We very much need a private sector renaissance in American higher education. That is what American business needs. That is what this entire country needs. And the future of America will be as bright as we make that private sector renaissance. People just now, in case you hadn't noticed, are pretty mad at their politicians. They're mad at their media. They're mad at their elementary and secondary schools. They're mad at their politically correct professors, and they should be. You can see it in the results of November's election. You can see it in the unprecedented 600,000 people on the Imprimis list and the continued very rapid growth of the journal. I believe the 1990s are going to be a time of very healthy change in American higher education and in our society as a whole. That change will not come from the top down. It never does when it really works. It will come from the bottom up. It will come from the minds and hearts of the American people who wish a different kind of education for their children, a different kind of conduct of their local communities and their affairs. Each of us has a role in that process. Sometimes it's very easy to assume we sent the people off to Congress. Good guys are there. This will all be taken care of now. I submit to you, no, it does not work that way. It is up to each of us to choose what that future will be for our sons and daughters and our grandchildren. Another century is about upon us, and the politics and economics and culture with which our children and grandchildren and their children live in that century will be directly the result of what you and I bring to it and what we are willing to say in our own centers of influence as these items are now being discussed here in American life. Don't defer that to someone else. C.S. Lewis put it better in just a few words than anyone else whom I've ever heard address the subject. He said, "You can't go on being a good egg forever. Sooner or later, you have to hatch or rot." And with no offense toward any of us here, myself included, we're all pretty well along the road toward one or another of those destinations. But you see, we happen to live in a creation presided over by a creator who believes so much in choice that he even wanted us to come to us as freely choosing agents. He'll allow us to choose to deny his very existence if we choose to do so. He wants us to come to him as freely choosing loving subjects. And I think that's what he expects of us in this life. We can choose to be comfortable, or we can choose to set about a reformation of American life, including higher education, that can give a different future to your children and mine just a few years from now. I believe the 90s will be the decade in which that occurs. I commend you to your task.
Well, thank you very much for that very inspiring close, Doctor, and that gives us all some real hope. As is our usual custom, we have some questions and we have a little time, so perhaps you can answer a few of them. So I'll start. Teachers' colleges are teaching kids how to make themselves feel good, but not about math and science. How do we break this closed system of teacher education?
Actually, this isn't such a new idea. Anyone familiar with the teaching profession knows that there were always two kinds of teachers, the people who were engaged in a popularity contest and those who expected you to learn something. And if you'll think back to which kind you preferred, which kind were memorable and made an impression upon you, invariably it will be category two, those who expected you to learn something, whom you most respected. The dumbing down process, that we don't really need to know anything as long as we all hug ourselves and feel good, is a very dangerous tendency for American education on any and all levels. I went to a country school, 8 grades in one room in the mountains in Colorado with one teacher who was very definitely in the learn your subject and learn it well category, and I look back on that as the best education I ever received in my life.
Yeah, I remember when I used to get my fingernails checked in the first grade. I remember that teacher. Now, this is from a Wayne State football fan. These questions, you talked about diversity. Here's some diversity in these questions. This is from a Wayne State football fan. What do you pay your football players?
That's privileged information, Bobby. Thank you. There is no question that one of the areas that I never even got around to addressing today, in which the same big bucks and the distortions coming from big bucks has also plagued American higher education, is in the field of big-time athletics. Fortunately, at Hillsdale, we deal with small-time athletics. We deal well with it. In the mid-1980s, we were the number one small college football team in the United States. We play and play well, and we like to win against opponents typically that are 5 or 10 or in some cases 25 times our size there at Hillsdale. However, we also believe in a concept called the student athlete. However unfashionable it is, we believe that you can get kids in school who can not only play ball but who can read and write. And at a very tough academic institution, and Hillsdale is a tough academic institution, our collective grade point for the entire football team is between a 2.8 and a 2.9. It's just a little less than a B average. We compete very well, nicely, and frankly, I think one of the reasons that we do compete so well is precisely because our youngsters are smart enough and motivated enough to do something besides play ball. That also shows up in how they play ball.
Great. Now let's move over to the faculty for a second. What is your view on tenure? Does it serve any purpose in this day and age?
It serves an essentially negative purpose in the present age, in the sense that it tends to protect, in most cases, those least able to compete, and at the expense of a rising competing class of younger professors, most able to compete. It puts the shoe on the wrong foot. It guarantees service over effectiveness and quality. It leads to, in many cases, the excesses of faculty senates who are in these institutions where they're running the entire school. I don't object to tenure as a guarantee of academic freedom or the right of a person to explore a subject and speak the truth as he understands that subject. That was the original intent and a worthy one. At Hillsdale, we have a slightly different approach to it. We do have a tenure program, in effect, but it is a tenure program defined by the faculty of the institution, and it says, among other things, that tenure is to be continued so long as it reflects the original levels of performance and achievement under which the tenure was granted. Now, think about that for just a second, and I don't object to that kind of tenure.
Great. Now, we're moving a little further afield here. This is called one of the great educators of our society, and it never takes place on campus. The question is, what can we do to stop the increasing immorality and violence on television, in the media, and in the movies?
Turn the television off. We live in an age that should be of concern to us on many levels, including the present culture. One of the things which most concerns me about that is the fact that the first, I'm a printhead, I'm one of the people that I essentially get my stuff from the printed page, I understand that. We moved on to a different age, and I'm not now talking about computers, so I guess that's one expression of it. We've moved to an age when a whole generation has now received their generation or two has received their entertainment values and attitudes from sitting and letting other people entertain them rather than singing, dancing, playing, or doing whatever you're doing. Somehow that comes to us from that all-pervasive tube or from that big screen. I think that in itself is very dangerous. I do not know the extent to which, and I doubt if anybody as yet knows, the full extent to which that impacts our social order. To the extent that youngsters do get their values from it, if they're getting it from the television, which I occasionally see, we are in a lot of trouble, not simply on the grounds of violence, but in general. I believe that one of the best things which might happen to a process would be the, oddly enough, here comes a very free market answer, would be a removal of licensure over a great deal of this. When you give something away because it's a free good, as, for example, the networks did for so many years, guaranteed that one of the things which will come from that is a pandering to the lowest common denominator, because the for free turns out to be a hook. Actually, what it is how do we get people to watch? And frankly, the ad men and the rest in this country have never been at any great pains to overrate the intelligence of the American people. Now, the best hope for that, as I say, is turn the darn thing off. But failing that, the less licensure, the less restraint, and the more competition there is in the process, the more opportunity for people to rally around quality programming of whatever kind, pay for it to have it in their home. I would gladly pay for such programming, and do in the case of a couple of respectable channels, I'm not going to give any commercials here, that I think do present things that I'm happy to see our 11-year-old son watching there. I don't think it's all bad, but the trouble is, as Say's Law said, to go back to economics again for a moment, the bad tends to drive out the good. And if we allow more avenues for the good, we might do better for ourselves. And meanwhile, if you really want to have an impact on Madison Avenue or whoever pays for the shows you don't like to see, turn it off. Believe me, that has an impact.
Well, you based a lot of your comments on the federal government intrusion into higher education. Didn't the federal government sue Hillsdale at one point?
I thought you'd never ask, Bob. Hillsdale in its 150 years has never accepted any federal money or money, political money of any kind. What did happen in the mid-1970s is that the federal government changed the rules of the game and for the first time came forward saying that the presence of a student on the Hillsdale campus who individually spent a federal dollar of an individual grant or loan there somehow made the institution as a whole recipient and subject to federal control. I thought at the time that was an enormous extension of the public into the private sector, a real stretch of logic. Nonetheless, that's what we were faced with, and so we were alone in doing this originally. We were joined later by some friends. But originally, we were alone in saying, we think that's wrong. We don't take government money here, and we're prepared to fight about it. That began a 10-year court battle, which went all the way through to the United States Supreme Court. We eventually lost. We lost on the Supreme Court level, and the present law of the land in this country is that the presence of a student on the Hillsdale campus who spends a federal dollar of an individual grant or loan there somehow makes the school as a whole recipient. Now, we protected our independence by immediately notifying the federal government that we would accept no students in the future who came there with federal dollars. But then we notified our parents and students that if their financial planning had required such a grant or loan, and if their ability to come to Hillsdale was based upon it, and if we wanted them there as students, we'd do everything we could to find private dollars to make it possible for them to attend. We've done so every year since the Supreme Court decision in 1984, and it costs a good many million dollars to do it, but we are still private, and we are still enabled to allow quality young people to attend Hillsdale College, with or without financial capacity.
Now, again, speaking about the federal government, do you feel as though the Department of Education should be eliminated?
Yes.
Very succinct answer. Okay, I am a naturalized U.S. citizen, and I'm shocked to find the government has taken over our education sector. Is it too late to get the monkey off the back? What should private schools do to survive this onslaught by the federal government?
One of the things which we've tried to do at Hillsdale to address that question is that we thought that much of present elementary and secondary education in the country was not in good shape, and that we wanted to try to set up a model school to show what might be done there. With that in mind, several years ago, we founded a Hillsdale Academy, kindergarten through eighth grade. We should have anticipated that the success of what we're doing would probably cause an expansion of the school. Now the plans are seriously underway with the trustees and with some financial support around the country to expand that kindergarten through 12th grade, and we'll be doing so within the next 2 years. While we're waiting to do that, we already have some very impressive results from this little school. Not in pioneering a new form of education, but simply returning to a very old form of education. For example, our students show up at school in uniforms. All the students, all the faculty, the headmaster stand up outside, run up the flag, say the Pledge of Allegiance. Then one of the young people is called upon to recite from memory something that he was assigned a couple of weeks before, to a psalm or a piece of poetry or whatever, which he recites to all of his peers in school, to the entire faculty and to all of his school, he stands and carries on what used to be called declamation. Very healthy thing. Then all the kids go inside and say their prayers. So far we have detected no serious damage to their psyches as the result of this. And we've returned to basic subjects. We actually teach geography, long forgotten. We teach American history, which refers to the founding fathers and the wonderful success story and growth and vitality that made this country what it was. In short, we go back to some very basic and fundamental ideas. Does it work? Well, I have a son there in the fifth grade, believe it or not. Incidentally, this 11-year-old's big brother is 40 years old, which shows that Mrs. Roach and I, whatever else we are very slow learners. But I'm a young parent, or at least the parent of a young child, and we like the school, and we like what's happening there. Believe me, it is quality education. We're 4.5 years into the process. There's an Iowa test score whereby you compare against all the publics and privates in terms of performance levels, all of the publics and privates in the United States. In all of our subjects in this little school, we are in the 95th percentile nationally. We're doing this for a little less than $4,000 a year per student. Do you know how magical that number is? compared with Michigan's $7,000, with New Jersey's $10,000, and so on around the country. Quality education, complete with values, but with definite academic skills, for $4,000 a head. We're very popular with the NEA. All this was by way of saying, and I really didn't finish, because really what this amounts to with this little model school is there are people all over the country, and Primus readers and the rest, that want to know more about it. So we've prepared curriculum material, we've prepared reading lists, we've prepared items on school culture that put a whole how-to book together that a homeschooler could use, that a private school could use. I think this is the beginning of one of those revolutions which will change the face of this country.
These are all, and everything you said is really all very simple. This is not rocket science we're talking about here. These are fundamental, sound, entrepreneurial ways of educating our children, which I'm a little perplexed by this next question, but I'd like to have you answer it. It says, Hillsdale receives tremendous outside financial support due to your unique message. For most colleges, that would not be possible, and therefore their survival without government support would be questionable. Is that correct?
I like to have somebody say that I'm unique. So usually it's phrased in a little different and less flattering way, Bob. Hillsdale, for a long while, has occupied a distinct place in American higher education because we very frankly have said who and what we are, what we stand for, and we have achieved a very widespread success as the result of that. But there's nothing magical about what we're saying or doing. The kind of education we're talking about at Hillsdale is the way generations of American youngsters were educated. We're talking about a private sector in education which used to be the way all American institutions of higher learning were originally founded. We're talking about returning to something that works. We're talking about abandoning a collective mentality that doesn't work. Why that would be limited only to Hillsdale, I'm glad to be the recipient of this wonderful American tradition, but I think that any number of other schools and institutions could benefit from it as well. And I think, as I said, for the reasons that I suggested, we live at the beginning of the Renaissance in which exactly that is going to happen.
I think the key, the implicit point in that message was, in that question, was the message. You're not the only person that can deliver this message. You do it extremely effectively, though. We keep hearing that education must change to meet the needs of industry. To meet this end, schools nationwide are entering into partnerships with businesses and corporations. How do you feel these partnerships will affect student learning?
I am sure there are places where the partnerships can be beneficial. Certainly the attempt to inject such aid and civic concern in the process is a healthy idea, and it's a positive thing. But I say to you, as some of the business people who might be involved in that process, make sure you are not just putting money into an existing system which is not doing what you don't really want it to do, and which you are in effect subsidizing to continue to totter along a little longer before it goes down. Make sure it really is innovative. Make sure you really are getting the bang for a buck which you want. I think if enough of us do that and do it aggressively enough, the Renaissance that I'm describing can come even sooner.
Great. Dr. Roach, that's all the time we have for questions. Thank you very much. I hope you all enjoyed this and appreciate it as much as I do.
Thank you, Dr. Roach, for addressing the Economic Club today, and thank you, Bob Nylot, for serving as our presiding officer. This meeting is adjourned.